I am here with Mr. Lonnie Jarrett. Lonnie has been active in the field of Chinese medicine since the 1980s. He is a leader, practitioner, and scholar. He wrote some Bibles, pretty much, that can tend to be prerequisites for Chinese medicine schools or associated texts. He has a master's in acupuncture. He also has a neurobiology degree?
Neurobiology
degree. He has a fourth degree black belt in Taekwondo. That takes work. And he also is a active practitioner of his acupuncture and herbal practice. Lonnie also manages or monitors NourishingDestiny.com, which is an online forum of thousands of practitioners that are committed to the growth and development and study of Chinese medicine. So thank you so much, Lonnie, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're kind of like the OG superstar here in our contemporary world regarding acupuncture. You have a popular name. You know this?
I don't really think of myself that way, but...
Because he's humble, right? So just to rewind and go all the way back to the spark, the place where you started, the
sure.
place that was maybe a visceral or maybe spiritual awakening, something that kind of woke up in you that was the process of how you began your journey. What was that spark like for you? And how has it stayed with you or evolved and continued to inform your work?
Well, you know, I knew I was going to be a healer when I was about 3 years old.
Wow.
I mean, it's a little trite, but my mother read me Bambi. And, you know, Bambi's mother gets killed, and I started crying. And she said, when you grow up, you can be a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this like it was yesterday, mm-hmm. but it was 56 years ago.
Wow.
And I said, what's that? And she said, a doctor who treats animals. And I said, okay, I'm going to be a doctor. And so being a doctor went through various iterations. When I was 17, I wrote my college entrance essay on the difference between Chinese philosophy and culture and Western philosophy and culture, and I talked about acupuncture. I started serious martial arts training in the mid-70s when I went to college. And my interest in medicine has always been consciousness. So the thing I went into was neurobiology.
Mm.
And I did serious work in that. I worked at Albert Einstein Medical School for a couple years in college and published research in leading journals. I worked at a lab at University of Massachusetts publishing research on the higher order structure of DNA. And that was 1980 when I was in that lab. And I took a 10-week course in Chinese medicine then.
Mm.
And the last day of the class, we were sitting in a circle around Emily Dickinson's grave
mm.
in Amherst, Massachusetts. And each person would stand up and talk the teacher would ask a few questions, and the person would talk, and then he'd say, what's their color, their sound, their odor, and emotion?
Mm.
And I got every patient right. And everyone in class was staring at me, and I was kind of floored.
Mm.
And I was like, oh my God. But at the same time, just within weeks of that, I had gotten a full scholarship to study neuroscience at the University of Michigan to get a doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
And I got through the coursework in that program, and it came to presenting my doctoral proposal, and I gave a proposal to study the innervation of the back shoe points, a category of acupuncture points,
mm-hmm.
and using the recently invented imaging technology of CAT scans
mm-hmm.
and radioimmunoassays and different neurobiological assessment techniques. And that didn't go over so well. The faculty was very, very conservative, and they didn't want me to use a doctorate to be able to promote Chinese medicine,
mm.
which they considered pure quackery. At about that time, I had this epiphany. I was using an electron microscope, and I was zooming in on brains in the cells of perhaps goldfish or salamanders. I can't remember at the time. And I went up to 100,000 magnification, and I went by all the mitochondria and ribosome and all the different parts of the nerve cells. And at about 100,000, I was in empty space, and
mm.
I zoomed back down and then back out. And it hit me, there's no consciousness here. Neuroscience has nothing to do with human consciousness.
How did that hit you in your body? How did that feel for you viscerally at that moment of finding that space, that void?
there was a sense of radical clarity, and also a sense of confusion, because on the one hand, my entire world had just been upended. I had left psychology because psychology was too hairy-fairy for me. There was sort of no there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, what we were studying was all humanistic psychology, and frankly, I couldn't relate to a lot of it. It was probably to what we would call green meme, pluralistic, relativistic, humanistic, and I wanted something hard science, mm-hmm. so I went into hard science thinking I'll be doing the real thing. And there was no consciousness there. So the rug was pulled out from under me, so I felt disoriented on the one hand, but this mystery evolved. It sort of appeared, and I said to myself, I have to do Chinese medicine. I have to give my life to this. That's where the action is. That's what I was really turned on to.
How much do you feel like your training in martial arts brought you to a place of being able to conceptualize this experience of a void through your intellectual mind, looking through a microscope?
You know, frankly, I'll be honest with you, not at all. The martial art I was doing was Taekwondo and Hapkido. These are very external. Now, I was training... In grad school, I was training no less than 10 and often 20 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I would train an hour and a half in the morning, go to school, take an hour class, teach an hour class. 11 o'clock at night, I'd go to the gym and train for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 5, 6, 7 days a week. It was very serious. But Taekwondo is a very materialistic martial art,
mm-hmm.
and Hapkido, Taekwondo is a sport, Hapkido is more like Kung Fu, but there's no real internal aspect to it. They integrated the hemispheres across the corpus callosum. They gave me a nuanced
balance,
movement,
sure.
and nuanced balance. But what really has done it for me is I also learned Qigong in 1980, and I practiced that. I do Qigong. Every morning I get up, I meditate 30 to 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But I did 2 hours a day for many years. Now, as soon as I get up, I do 30 to 40 minutes meditation and 20 minutes of Qigong nearly every day of my life. And I would attribute the deeper inner dimensions to what I've seen through meditation.
In that practice.
Through meditation.
Sure. Well, that brings me to another question. We talked yesterday. We had a beautiful lecture. It was almost 3 hours long. Really amazing, thick, dense material that was fabulous to listen to.
Just so you know, none of it's abstract to me.
I can tell.
So I'm always just speaking from my own experience.
Right. Well, and it's very poetic, and you really bring it into practical reality, which brings me into a question about ethics around individual practitioners. You had mm-hmm. said something that really stuck out to me, that most people who practice traditional Chinese medicine or classic Chinese medicine don't believe in it. How does that relate to the embodiment or the ability to carry this medicine to the public for practitioners?
Well, we have to have integrity to whatever we're practicing. I said in the lecture that it's a practitioner's moral obligation to be a living expression of the type of wholeness that the medicine predicts is possible.
Mm.
So we can abstractly conceive of Chinese medicine as an internal sort of family therapy where we have these 12 organs called officials and we're trying to establish harmonious relationships between them. But nobody's going to have the capacity to engender a higher integrity within a patient than their actual relationships with other human beings look in their own life.
Mm-hmm.
Our relationships with other individuals is going to be the embodied, practical, pragmatic, and realized expression of the clarity and simplicity and wholeness that we have within ourselves. When I said most practitioners of Chinese medicine don't believe in it, specifically what I mean is this. The theoretical foundation of Chinese medicine and homeopathy is that we can institute a very small signal, a small but not insignificant mm-hmm. signal, difference into a human being as a complex system. And that small but not insignificant signal can create a radical change around which the entire self system of the human being organizes.
Mm-hmm.
which also creates a change in culture because the individual is culture.
Hmm.
How many practitioners of Chinese medicine or homeopathy or any medicine live their life like the future of the human race depends on their own enlightenment and integrity, their own level of kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Most people would be cynical and say, oh me, what can I do? I'm just one person.
Mm-hmm.
Are they really living their life like they can tip the balance toward the true, the good, the beautiful, toward the emergence?
Mm-hmm. So even to expand on that idea of cultural medicine and really opening the dialogue to determine how an individual heals and how they heal their life has a direct impact on not only themselves, but their relationships and their relationship to their role within their social structure. So what way do you feel Chinese medicine or maybe even any other, whether it be body talk or energetic modalities, really are getting at healing the culture through the individual?
Well, not at all, but the potential is there. So for those who are, you know, this is going out to Colorado predominantly. So Mr. Ken Wilber lives in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Ken's integral theory, all emergence is always occurring in four quadrants of emergence. So there's the personal subjective, there's the collective subjective, so there's the upper left quadrant, which is I, there's the lower left quadrant, which is we, there's the upper right quadrant, which is it, and the lower right quadrant, which is its. So all emergent phenomenon is always occurring in these quadrants. Now different forms of healing have their own biases toward these quadrants. So Chinese medicine is very biased toward the upper left quadrant and what we'd call functional medicine.
Sure.
And
how am I doing? What is going
well,
on in my world?
More than that, but when I'm diagnosing you, I'm diagnosing it through my impressions and my felt impressions, and I'm seeing I'm seeing blue around the face, and I'm seeing this on your tongue, and I'm feeling this on your pulse, and it feels choppy to me, and I just saw you look up there, and they're all my sensory impressions. Do you see?
There's a filter. It's through your vehicle.
Yes, which is all qualitative, not quantitative.
Western
biomedicine has a strong bias toward the upper right quadrant. It ignores the entire infinity of functional infinity beneath the surface in the person's soul and in their mind and in their spirit and in their heart and the infinite depths of the self. And it's just looking at what we would consider from a depth perspective to be the superficial ripples on the surface. What's your pulse rate? What's your liver enzymes? Not that that's bad. That's very good. Contextually, if you're in a car crash or you're shot by a gun or you have meningitis. The point is that if we're practicing integral medicine, which is the medicine that I'm working hard to bring into the world, we're always looking at the patient from a four-quadrant perspective. So when I'm treating the patient, I'm not just diagnosing their constitution and their acquired pathologies. I'm diagnosing the level of culture they're at. Which we can talk about according to spiral dynamics or Susan Cook Reuter's level of Terry O'Fallon's levels of ego development. We can look at all these different levels of development that the Maslow and Lovinger and all these different levels of development. So I can look according to that. I can look at what level of culture they're at their state and stage development individually, culturally, and then when I identify the level of culture they're at, where are they within that culture? Are they just coming into it and they need to stabilize? Are they stabilized within it? Or are they bumping their heads on the limits and challenge of that culture?
And which is a huge thing. Most people really find that they bump their heads on the limits and challenge of culture. We have things like economic issues, racial issues. We have systemic things that are barriers that are put in that affect individuals. So what way do you feel that there's a potential, maybe even looking at the culture, of how do we change the way culture supports us? Is that something that you assess clinically? How your culture supports you? What kind of economic status are you at? How do you have transportation? What's your interpersonal relationships? Are you satisfied?
Of course. I'm looking at all of this, and there are different levels of culture. So immediately, if you and I are doing a session, there's a culture in the room of you and me. I've written in my books early on, you're never diagnosing the patient, you're only ever diagnosing the relationship between you and the patient, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no such thing as pure subjectivity. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as pure objectivity. Mm-hmm. These are ideals that we can contemplate, mm-hmm. but they don't exist. Sure. We can look through the eyes of them for the sake of seeing a perspective. Mm-hmm. I'll point out that in the West right now, you know, all our models are based on the same sort of Cartesian linear causal sure. effect. So medicine is no different than politics. So
I was just about to ask that.
Well, medicine is politics. Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with medicine in the West? I wait until you're sick, and then I give you antibiotics, or I bomb what you've got with radiation. Sure. And how do we deal with politics? Not preventively, we wait till you crash planes into the trade towers, and then we go and drop bombs mm-hmm. on the country. And bombing an infection with antibiotics just causes antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and those bacteria are evolving in the same way that our response to the World Trade Towers have caused ISIS to arise. Mm. The bacteria just get more clever, mm-hmm. and all the planes and warships in the world are not going to be able to get that bacteria that is in a sleeper cell. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, for instance, Lyme disease learns to go into cyst form and sure. can hide in the mm-hmm. nervous system. So when the antibiotics are there, it can completely hide from it.
So this really illustrates this microcosm, macrocosm aspect of how the environment that we're in affects us, and we in turn affect that. Where we have, you said something about too. You can't evolve as a practitioner, you're not going to help people evolve further than where you've already really evolved yourself. So how do we, at this point in our time right now, whether we look at through the lens of Western culture or even global culture, how do we start embracing these ideas to have them inform medicine to look at the way our environments begin to impact our biology?
Well, look, I mean, this all started with the Transcendentalists. Mm-hmm. And with Emerson mm-hmm. and the Transcendentalists. So when you say, how do we begin to do it? Well, we've already begun to do it. And the stage and state developments of culture, you know, there's a first tier. Mm-hmm. The first six memes are all at war with each other. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the survival meme up through tribal ethnocentric consciousness, mm-hmm. mythocentric consciousness, scientific rationalism, and then ultimately pluralism, relativism, mm-hmm. all of those memes are at war with each other. They only see their way. But there's this what Claire Graves calls this momentous jump to second tier, where we have a top-down perspective, mm-hmm. and we can all of a sudden start appreciating all of the strengths and weaknesses of the previous levels of development. And we can transcend and include. So we can include the best that each state and stage has brought to us mm-hmm. while always looking to go further. Mm-hmm. While always looking to go further. So right now the estimates are that 5% of the world are at what we could call second tier levels of development. Mm. And you need to get about 10% of the world at a stage of development before it just starts influencing everything and spreading like wildfire. Ken Wilber's new book, The Fourth Turning, The Future of Religion, he talks all about this. And, it is a question of which wave is going to crest first. Are we going to get enough people there to be serious systems thinkers and at an integrated level of development where the transpersonal dimensions of the self are identified with that, let's say, a 51% level of development.
Right.
Not where ego is gone, mm-hmm. but where ego has been transcended to the degree that it's a fully functioning, healthy stage of development, but the transpersonal stages beyond it are also in the picture and informing our personalities and our actions and our values, most importantly, our values and our behaviors in the world. Are we going to reach a level of development where enough of us reach that before the biosphere is destroyed in a way that we can't go back? And I'd like to think that we can, but I'm not placing any bets. But there's nowhere to go, you know, damn the torpedo straight ahead. We'll either do it or die trying.
Sure. So if you were to expand the definition of war to include things like social injustices, economic injustices, racism, domestic violence, police brutality, prison industrial complexes, and something that is, you know, a distant look that is far fought off of our soil, what would you feel the role of healers is in times of war?
It's a great question. You know, on the one hand, so just sitting here with that, on the one hand, what I feel arise within me is there's a humility about the capacity of what we can do. Mm-hmm. And there's the straight ahead, damn the torpedoes, we're going to do this or die trying. Mm-hmm. And what can we do? I mean, it all begins with the level of integrity we have in ourselves and the degree to which we've overcome our own cynicism, the level of wholeness that I'm living as an individual. And this really comes down for me to the Bodhisattva vow, which is the recognition that medicine is not something I practice. It's not work I do for a living. It's not something I'm practicing in the treatment room. It's not a collection of knowledge or a collection of techniques. It is the commitment I have in every interaction, every relationship. It is a life that I'm giving my life to. And that life has to do with catalyzing the emergence of the true, the good, the beautiful through every interaction. And this really starts with the self. I really do believe that it is my experience. It goes beyond belief. It is my undoubted experience that there's one consciousness in the world, and I get to work directly with that, both with myself and through all my patients. And this is why I have a varied career. Clinical, we have to ask ourselves the question, what is the relevance of Mrs. Jones' sciatica or carpal tunnel syndrome in the context of having her species threatened with extinction? So I'm not saying there's no context, but I'm saying I'm not saying there's no relevance.
Sure.
I'm saying what is the relevance? And the main relevance to me is the opportunity of medicine, is the evolution of values through the production of wholeness.
It's beautiful. Talk about your ideas on seeking health or healing versus being healed.
Sure. So conservative people like to go to doctors to get drugs and surgeries so they can feel better without having to change. And liberals like to go to acupuncturists, homeopaths, and bodywork therapists so they can feel better without having to change. So the three principles that I'm trying to institute in medicine are integral. Integral means there's no separation, recognized separation between patient and practitioner. I need to be a living expression of the kind of wholeness my medicine predicts is possible. And I need to have a kind of integrity that before I say a word, just through resonance alone, destroys the cynicism of a patient regarding their own capacity to overcome their own resistance and move to higher state and stages of development.
Wow, and that's really this idea of inspiring people to live a different life and be accepted to where they are in their life and create the change that they will then impart in their own life outside of our treatment rooms. Because that's what I always tell people, is like there's a lot we can do on a table, but you have to walk back into your life with that. You have to treat your spouse or your children different. You have to live in your culture or express your honesty of who you are. And I can't do that for anyone. It's where it really comes in, is how do we empower people to do that?
Right, and it's an interesting thing. I had an interesting lesson early on. I was treating a patient for tinnitus, and at the seventh, he agreed to come for 10 weeks, and at the seventh treatment, he said, look, this really isn't helping, and I'm moving away in 3 weeks. We were doing 10 weeks because in 10 weeks, he was going to move to another community with his family to get another job. And I said, look, just come for the last three treatments. You never know. And I gave him the last three treatments, and he said, you've been very kind, but this has done nothing for me. And he left, and I felt very badly about it, of course. And a week later, I answered my telephone in my office, and his wife was on the phone in tears saying, I don't know what you've done with my husband, but I have the man I married back. He's laughing all the time. He's affectionate. you know, he's touching me again, he's happy, he's playing with the kids. I don't know what you've done, but it's complete magic.
Mm.
Right? So for me, it's always incredible to get unsolicited mm-hmm. feedback from friends or family saying, you know, I know this person who's working with you, and I just have to tell you, you know, they're my employee or they're my boss or mm-hmm. I work with them at the co-op. And then you see this lower left quadrant changing.
Mm-hmm.
And then and then in terms of the lower right quadrant, there are different family rules. They start changing mm-hmm. the rules in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And then the lab tests come back and the creatinine's lower
mm-hmm.
or the liver enzymes are lower, you
mm-hmm.
see. Or physically they're saying, I'm not having cigarettes. So you see actual physical things
mm-hmm.
changing. So the three perspectives are integral, evolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
Evolutionary means integral change and development with no preconceived endpoint in all lines of development.
Mm-hmm.
So the traditions, the Eastern traditions, but all the traditions were circular, born when there was circular time.
Mm.
Certainly Taoism was.
Yeah.
Well, the painted ponies go round and round.
Mm-hmm.
We're all riding on a carousel of time.
Mm-hmm.
To everything, turn, turn, turn.
Mm-hmm.
There is a season.
Mm-hmm.
The Taoists talked all about transformation, but not evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution is the spiral. It's where the circle meets the absolute
mm-hmm.
straight line,
mm-hmm.
and then they come together in the spiral.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the circle and the line.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why spiral dynamics I find to be so beautiful.
Beautiful.
Don Beck is one of the leading teachers of spiral dynamics. Ken Wilber, I would consider the leading interpreter of it. And then the last principle that I'm teaching is I look through the lens of spirituality. And to me, what we're not just working with chi. Chi is such an abstract concept.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me what chi is, it's everything,
mm-hmm.
and it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about as much as you can say about it. It what chi is relatively abstract. We only know it by its absence or its excess. But spirit, to me, we're really looking to unleash the force of spirit, and it has two directions. The Eastern direction of spirit is transcendence. It's return back to the root,
mm-hmm.
realizing the self as emptiness and abiding there, the unborn and the undying self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you look at Buddha. Buddha had nowhere to go and nothing to do, sitting under the Bodhi tree.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at Jesus Christ. Jesus is on the path and somebody says, I recognize you as my teacher. I'd like to follow you, but first I have to bury my dead father according to Hebrew law. Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead. Everybody mm-hmm. else, let's go. He's got somewhere to go and something
mm-hmm.
to bring mm-hmm. heaven to earth. When?
Mm-hmm.
Now.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the two directions of spirit, transcendence and immanence.
Mm-hmm.
And you had asked me a question before, and I'm not sure if I answered it.
Maybe about the difference between healing and being healed.
Yes. So the point is there are many seekers. We meet many seekers and very few finders.
Mm.
Everybody's interested in healing, but mm-hmm. how many people do you meet are being healed?
Mm.
And healing is something to get done with sooner than later. What has happened is, with the advent of the green meme in postmodernism, we've taken the idea of healing, which was significantly a physical concept. You break your leg, it needs time to heal.
Mm-hmm.
Your body is wounded. The body needs time to heal, significantly often,
mm-hmm.
right? You get burnt. It's going to take time to heal. But on the level of psychology, at the level of the mind, at the level of the soul, healing can be instantaneous.
Mm.
Because the foundation of that healing is really the recognition of who I actually am. Who am I? Why am I here? How shall I live? Patients always want to cut to how shall I live? Should I marry? Should I get married? Should I get divorced? Should I have another kid? Should I sell my house? Should I buy a new house? Should I go back to graduate school? Should I move from the East Coast to the West Coast? That's what should I do?
Mm-hmm.
How shall I live?
Mm-hmm.
If you answer those questions without knowing who you are, you're just going to be perpetuating karma and the same, putting another brick in the wall.
Sure.
But as soon as I realize who I actually am, as both the unborn and the creative impulse,
mm-hmm.
simultaneously, as emptiness and that luminosity, that fire exploding out of emptiness as Eros, the creative impulse, the evolutionary impulse. As I recognize myself as the synthesis of both of those things, then I'll know how to live. Then I'll know what to do. It readily becomes apparent.
And they have the capacity to really understand it. Something you talked about even in your lecture is sensation or thought really are just masks or just experiences that aren't really us, that can be fleeting, that we can shift our attention away from, or we can shift our attention into. And those attentions, you know, the energy flows where the intention goes, and that can become our pathology, or it becomes our liberation when we just decide to not get it.
Well, thought, feeling, sensation, and emotion are objects in awareness. That doesn't mean they aren't real. And it doesn't mean one shouldn't discount them. You don't want to be abiding in emptiness while you're riding your bicycle down the street. They say, the traffic light's red, a car is coming. There is no traffic light. There is no car. It's all a projection. When somebody tells me you're a projection of my mind, I always want to slap them in the face and say, that's a very weird thing for you to have just done.
That's great. So just to wrap it up, to anchor it down, your book, Nourishing Destiny, like I started the interview with, has been a staple, a cornerstone foundation for so many people studying the work of Chinese medicine.
Yes.
You talk about the heart-kidney access, and
yes.
This is something I take particular interest in, not only as a body talk practitioner, but personally as a mother for my children. I enrolled them in a school that is based on the philosophy that if we build the will, we build the capacity to want to work, to want to use our energy towards something, it then gives a container of structure for us to express the spirit and express through the heart. And I found clinically that is that capacity of the function of those two areas working together that has such a vital importance to how people's health organizes when they are on their path, when they are doing their purpose, when they are moving towards their destiny. If you were to delve into that a little bit and give our listeners maybe one or two practical things about this idea of the heart-kidney access and what they could do immediately in their own behaviors or lifestyles that might help them to nourish their own destiny.
Well, the heart-kidney access is the same as the Tai Chi, as in Tai Chi Chuan. It's the axis. It's the central axis of the self, that which never moves, that which orients to the North Star, through GV-20 at the top of the head, Governor Vessel 20. So it's a central axis of the self around which all of creation revolves. So it's the absolute perspective. So, I mean, it's very interesting, right? Because on the one hand, absolute perspective is an oxymoron, because a perspective is always relative to another perspective. It's not absolute. So absolute perspective is an oxymoron, but if we say there are no absolutes, nothing is absolute, that's an oxymoron because it's an absolute statement. So somewhere between the two, there's a mystery. Bruce Lee, in his book Tao of Jeet Kune Do, says that to really overcome karma and to really strengthen the mind and will and overcome karma, one has to transcend the illusion of a personal destiny. So many people, postmodern people, like my book Nourishing Destiny, because they think, they relate to Nourishing Destiny as I'm here and I have a purpose, my own special purpose, and I have to do that, which can be easily rationalized into I need to do whatever I feel like doing whenever I feel like doing it, and or I'm repressing, and if I'm repressing, that's not healthy, so I have to be completely self-expressed.
Oh, the excuses.
I have to be completely self-expressed, so I should do what I want whenever I want to, just because I want to, and no one can judge me. None of our destinies are separate. There is an individual destiny. I mean, we are all here for a purpose. Significantly, that's a shared purpose. But that does have an individual expression. And I would have made a lousy accountant. And, you know, I'm a reasonably good Chinese medicine practitioner and author. The question you're asking me, right, I mean, depends on a person's socioeconomic level of development, significantly. The medicine I practice is a medicine of freedom. Ideally, a person's job in life is going to reflect and give them an opportunity to reflect and to give their special gifts and talents in the world and to utilize them. But it's what percentage of the 25% of the population might be at a level of socioeconomic fortune where they can do a job just because they want to, or if they discover they love, if you were to discover that you wanted to do something else for a living, you could probably just say, I'm going to go get another master's degree, or I'm going to do this. A lot of people have to work at the job they're at that doesn't give them an expression.
I would agree with you in some level, but at a certain level, I've worked very hard for my work, and I come from pretty much poverty, and it was a choice, and it was a choice to work hard, and it was a choice to struggle, and it was a choice to say, I'm not going to do anything else but direct myself to this path, and, you know, not having a benefactor to help support me do that really gave me the process over 15 years
of
learning.
Nelson Mandela spent 28 years in solitary confinement, and
so it's like we could do what we
want.
And
he brought down apartheid. So there is always the potential of free agency, but as individuals, there are always cultural forces.
Sure.
And I think this is just important to understand at the level of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
But when you ask me, you know, what can a person do, I'd make the distinction between being serious and deadly serious. Right? So most of the listeners here are probably serious. We've gotten degrees, we've gotten graduate degrees. Nobody's listening to this who's not passionate about these kind of issues.
Sure.
If they weren't, they'd have turned off 30 seconds into this and probably be listening to banjo music. Just a joke. Okay, so so the point is, we're all, many people are serious, but when you're serious, there's still time in the picture. Right? I'm working on it. I'm working on it. And when you're deadly serious, there's no time left. It has to happen now. So I am a baby boomer. I'm 59. When you're 50, 50 is the age at which, if you're paying any attention at all, you can no longer harbor the illusion of having infinite time left to get the important things. And I would say the most important thing people could do is take time out of the picture. And to really contemplate, to what degree am I a living reflection of my highest ideals? And what are those, the highest ideals that most move me? And what have I placed in the way of living up to them? What do I think I have to work out before I can actually do it? And just realize that's the attachment to that thing is unwholesome. And just take that out of the picture. Take time. Taking time out of the picture quickens the process.
Beautiful. You guys heard it first here. You need to be deadly serious if you want the true mark of your own evolution.
And have, right, and, you know, enjoy life and be kind.
Beautiful. Lonnie, thank you so much for your time and your energy today.
And I'd just like to say, I get interviewed a lot. That's the best interview the best interviewer that I've done, so.
You heard.
Kudos.
Thank you so much.
I've
heard that before. I feel like I got thrown to the wolves with my interviewing career.
No, and, I,